Welcome to Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar. May is Mental Health Awareness Month, a time to bring attention to a topic that many Americans don't talk about, or if they do, they often won't admit when they are suffering from poor mental health. There still is a stigma attached to mental health and especially mental illness. Breaking down the barrier of stigma is one of the biggest challenges we face today. We'll address a number of different mental health related topics today and answer your questions. Our guest today, Christine Michael, is Chief Executive Officer with the National Alliance on Mental Illness, Keystone, Pennsylvania. Ms. Michaels, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Also joining us is Shalon James, Director of Program Advocacy with the Mental Health Association in Pennsylvania. Ms. James, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
And Dr. Gina Cavorsi, Chief Medical Officer with Lancaster Behavioral Health Hospital. Dr. Cavorsi, good to see you this morning.
Good morning.
If you have a question or comment, in fact, we encourage you to ask questions about mental health. Give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@WITF.org. You can leave a question or comment on WITF's Facebook page. On Twitter, we are at Smart Talk WITF. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Chris Michaels, let me start with you. Mental Health Awareness Month. I know that very often the awareness part is dropped and it's just called Mental Health Month. Why is there a need to be aware of mental health?
Well, for the public to be aware, and the awareness is probably the biggest tool that we have to combat the stigma that's associated with mental illness. Anti-stigma awareness, anti-stigma education, anti-stigma campaigns are, you know, a primary responsibility of our organization. I mean, it's a daily battle to eliminate the stigma. And
so I guess the reason I asked that question, yes, it's to make the public aware, but what isn't the public aware of?
Well, I think that the main thing is that mental illness, mental health problems are extremely common. One in five people will experience some mental health issue or condition. It's very common, and it's very treatable. And I think that's the biggest thing that people aren't aware of. And instead, they have a vision of, when you say mental illness, they have a pretty graphic picture of a homeless person, you know, talking to themselves on the street, and potentially violent. And that's just a horrible, horrible image of mental illness.
And we'll talk about that myth about violence and mental illnesses throughout the program. Shalon James, I know this sounds like a simple question, but when Chris Michael says that it's common, as part of your job with the Mental Health Association in Pennsylvania, I guess here's a simple question. How common? And by that, I'm not looking for statistics, but just kind of give us a sense of what we see in Pennsylvania today.
Sure. So with around stigma and awareness, and when you're talking about Mental Health Awareness Month, I think a lot of the stigma and where it seems to be that people don't think that it's a common thing is the fear around that it's happening to me or it's happening to my family. And so every single one of us knows somebody, if not our own selves, that deals with mental health on a daily basis. Even when you're looking at, you're about to come on the radio and give an interview and you have sweaty palms and you're having a little bit of anxiety.
Now, who would that be?
That would be me right now.
Oh, okay. So you're talking about anxiety.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Right, okay.
So you that I'm experiencing that right now. My palms are sweaty, my arms are like I'm going through it.
I would say that.
Is, right. But that is what mental health is. And it's my awareness of I'm going through this. And so how do I use my toolbox and my resources around me to say, okay, I can get through this. And we all deal with that every day. Or you see something on the news and it triggers something in you. It triggers an emotion in you and you don't know why you're upset. You don't know why you're tearful around it. That is all mental health. We deal with mental health every day. I think we are really good as a society with promoting physical health. So getting on the treadmill and exercising every day and eating the right amount of carbs and fats and vitamins and all of those things. But we lack in dealing with our mental health. How do we take time away from the things that are stressing us in life? Work, kids, traffic, all of those kind of things. How are we taking time to deal with our mental health and say, I need to take a break from this and I need to find my happy place and deal with the mental health aspect of general health?
Well, you know, I really give you credit for the example that you gave, because in my 10 years, you're the first one admitted they had sweaty palms and were nervous.
Yeah.
I mean, on the air anyway. I mean, I have had some off the air. But the example that you just gave is when we talk about mental illness, people, I think, anyway, have a tendency to think of severe mental illness.
Yes.
And don't often think about depression or anxiety, that the kind of episodes that people go through every day when facing stress or something going wrong. So, Dr. Cavorsi, let me ask you the same question. At the Lancaster Behavioral Health Hospital, you treat people who are going through mental health issues or living with mental illness. And both our other guests have said that this is common. We all know someone. If we haven't lived through it ourselves, we all know someone who has, but it often they don't come right out and say it. But you see that every day, correct?
I do see that every day. When we talk about 1 in 5 Americans having some type of mental health issues, 1 in 25 have significant issues that interfere with their ability to function on a daily basis. What we encounter at the hospital, you know, when we talk about stigma and people's fear of seeking help, there's a lot of shame. Mm-hmm. There's no shame with other types of illness, with physical illness. Mm-hmm. People feel ashamed. They feel guilty. They hide. I mean, we talk about the fact that when someone is hospitalized in a psychiatric hospital, are people offering to bring you flowers?
Right.
Like they would in a medical hospital.
Right.
You know, are people offering to help your family during that time? Mm-hmm. Folks don't want to talk about it. And it's bringing that awareness that, hey, this affects your mother, father, friends, family. Everybody knows somebody.
You know, one of the best examples of what you're describing, I had a guest one time who whose daughter had been diagnosed with a severe mental illness. And he said that if my daughter had cancer, if my daughter had a heart condition, the neighbors would be coming over with some meals for us and mm-hmm. calling every day and say, how's your daughter doing? But with mental illness, no one asks about it. Mm-hmm. And that does add to the stigma that people don't know what to say, and at the same time, that is conveyed to the family members, the person suffering, that, well, they don't want to talk about it, so I'm ashamed of it. I'm embarrassed by it. So, Chris Michaels, I mean, all these things you're hearing, I'm sure, sound very familiar.
Oh, yes. Yes. And I mean, one of the main issues that we encounter, and I know the other folks on the radio, is untreated mental illness, and the problem with untreated mental illness, stigma is a big impediment to people seeking treatment. So they can start out with perhaps not a most serious condition, but because it goes untreated for a period of time, it becomes more serious. And I mean, the two primary reasons that people do not seek treatment are, insurance and stigma.
Mm-hmm. Mm. And we're going to talk about insurance as well. I want to take a phone call from Bill in Lancaster. Bill, you're on the air.
Good morning.
Good morning, Bill.
Morning to Chris, too. Now, Chris just said something about it's treatable. Well, maybe. Here's a bit of a history for the last 2 years with my wife, who has had some problems. And she refuses to go to doctors. She argues with me over taking the medicines that the psychiatrist has and the family doctor for diabetes has recommended. She rails and goes off the wheels every once in a while and becomes irascible. And nobody can seem to help. Nobody is there to help. I feel like I'm isolated. Plus, there were times earlier on when she was railing about being suicidal, that she can't live this way. She hates her body. She wishes she were dead. Why was she born? So I called up a couple of the suicide hotlines to ask what they could do, and their answer was, has she cut herself or hurt herself?
Mm-hmm.
No. Has she hurt you or anybody else? No. Well, then there's nothing we can do about it. Mm-hmm. Now, that is so ridiculous on the surface. It's like I called up and said, hey, my neighbor just bought 6 AR-15s and 10,000 rounds of ammunition. Has he shot anybody? No. Has he threatened anybody? No. Oh, then we can't do anything.
Hey, Dr. Cavorsi, how about, can you handle Bill's question?
Yeah, absolutely. Unfortunately, this is not an uncommon story in terms of what people are experiencing when they are seeking help. It is really difficult. This is a difficult type of set of illnesses to face. And we forget that about the families and how the families are impacted, you know, in trying to help their loved one. It can feel like a very hopeless situation sometimes, especially when they're thinking about their loved one's recovery and the family's recovery. And I think,
let me interrupt for a moment.
Sure.
She has been under treatment for 2 years, including a week at Philhaven in Mount Gretna.
Yes. And I think one of the key things really is access to resources, access to care, access to supports in the community.
But it sounds like he has access. It's
right.
Just what happens, what do you do when the person
refuses treatment?
Right, who refuses treatment. And one of the keys that I heard there was refuses to take medication, because we know that that's when someone is most susceptible to an episode or to a severe illness. So what can you do when the person refuses to be treated?
Yes, what happens is I get yelled at by her that I'm controlling her because I give her her medicine, and why am I always on her back to take the medicine?
Well,
I think it's, you know, you can't take someone and pull them along in terms of telling them what they need to do, because it has to be self-motivated. Mm-hmm. What we try to do at our hospital is sit down with folks and come approach their treatment from a strengths-based perspective and find out what are their goals and how does taking medication and following up with appointments, how does that fit into their overall plan for what they want to do with their lives. We have a strong emphasis on recovery and trying to see what it is that folks want to accomplish, and then we try to use that as our motivating factor to help people take medication and see the value in it. It's
sure.
A different model. It's more of an individual-based, an individual-centered model.
Shalom, go ahead. What do you want to add there?
Everybody's journey is different. Everybody's journey to recovery is going to be different. And so what I would encourage you to do, I believe your name is Bill.
Bill, yeah.
What I would encourage you to do is, right now, she is not in a place where she is ready. And or she's not in a place where she feels like she's even ill. And so for you as a family member who is seeing this very difficult transition for your wife, stay the course. provide her with options. So maybe she doesn't want to take the medication, but what do you want to do? What kind of things can we put in place for you that you are willing to do? Because the more buy-in that you can get from somebody that is going through a mental illness, the better their outcome will be.
Yeah, we've been doing that for, as I say, almost 2 years, at least a year and a half. Now, is there any way that I could contact your office, shall we say?
Yes, absolutely. So our hospital is on Harrisburg Pike
in Lancaster.
Lancaster Behavioral Health Hospital. We are open 24 hours a day. We have a 24-hour assessment center. So folks can walk right in through the front doors and receive a very thorough mental health assessment. What we do from there is that we can refer to either outpatient resources, if appropriate, or inpatient, if we feel that the person's in crisis and needs immediate treatment. It's actually a really wonderful way to have things set up because it helps people to bypass places like the emergency room, which can be hectic, busy, overstimulating for folks, that they can come right to us if there's no medical or physical emergency that's occurring.
Hey, Bill, I can hear frustration, and I know it's tough, but see what you can do.
I appreciate to offer to Bill what NAMI has to offer to family members.
We were an organization founded by family members. With the 90-some-year-old woman that runs NAMI over here in Lancaster.
Yes.
I can't remember her name, and I went to F2F for 12 weeks last summer.
You went to the class?
Yes.
To family class?
Yes.
And how about her support group?
I go occasionally. It's good to talk to somebody, but, you know, I basically know what we should be doing, but it's kind of like telling a rabid dog to do something, and they don't want to do it.
Well, I think that one of the points I would like to make with you, with respect, is that and as part of the class, the 12-week class, is self-care. I mean, I think that you know, you need to take care of yourself so that you
can help
your wife when she's ready.
Yeah, no, I've been trying to do that. There's no problem as far as that goes. As I say, I'm doing everything right according to everything in the classes and in the NAMI meetings and everything. But I'm not getting any cooperation on the other end, which makes it very difficult and frustrating.
Well, again, Bill, good luck, and see what you can do.
Thank you very much.
Right.
Appreciate it.
All right.
Bye-bye.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Before we get back into our conversation, I wanted to remind you that coming up on June 6th, 75th anniversary of D-Day, Smart Talk will be on a road trip to the Eisenhower Historic Site in Gettysburg, and we invite you to join us. You could go to WITF.org to RSVP. We'll be talking about D-Day, President Eisenhower, and of course he was General Eisenhower during D-Day, planned the D-Day invasion. Bit of history that's coming up on June 6th, week from Thursday. And again, if you'd like to go, just go to WITF.org. Today's program, May, right at the very end of May, we're talking about Mental Health Awareness Month. Our guest today, Christine Michaels, Chief Executive Officer with the National Alliance on Mental Illness, NAMI, Keystone, Pennsylvania. Shalon James, Director of Program Advocacy with the Mental Health Association in Pennsylvania. And Dr. Gina Cavorsi, Chief Medical Officer with Lancaster Behavioral Health Hospital. If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk at WITF.org. On Twitter, we are at smarttalk, WITF. Again, the phone number, 1-800-729-7532. I had an email here from a listener that wanted me to ask this question. I believe in some social circles, there is a stigma surrounding mental health treatment. However, everyone appreciates when people are receiving treatment. I feel like mental health treatment would be less stigmatized if mental health wellness visits were included in the Affordable Care Act as preventative treatment, similar to well child visits. Also, copays for mental health care tend to be high, and usually the copays are the highest health insurance plans offered to the bottom middle class. Medicaid recipients generally have very low to no copays for almost everything, and the Cadillac plans normally do not have high copays either. If mental health wellness visits were somehow included in the ACA as a wellness visit, then there would be no copay for the first visit, and I think it would be a step in the direction of normalizing mental health care. Chris Michaels, you kind of brought this up earlier. Well, not kind of. You did when you said that stigma and insurance were two of the biggest issues. So what do you have to say to that listener and the points that she brings up?
I agree with her. I agree that you know, mental health wellness visits would be ideal, starting with children. Starting with infants, there's a whole community that is working on, you know, infant mental health, so that it's, you know, mental illness has been recognized as a developmental type of disorder. So the earlier you can start, you know, screening for it and assessing, the better. I absolutely agree that mental health wellness visits would be a great step in the right direction.
Would you like to weigh in on that?
Sure. This is Dr. Gavorsi. I mean, I think that we are really starting to recognize the need for more behavioral health specialists in primary care settings. And I know a lot of health systems are starting to move in that direction, where they are integrating those professionals into primary care practices so that they're readily accessible for at least an initial evaluation. 70% of folks with depression and anxiety are actually managed out of their PCP's office. Mm-hmm. We have a national shortage of mental health professionals, including psychiatrists. Yep. So I think the bigger health systems are starting to take a look at this and the importance of it. Same thing of, you know, taking care of your blood sugars if you're a diabetic to avoid a costly medical hospitalization. It pays to do the same for mental health as well.
Do primary care physicians ask a patient about their mental health?
A lot are moving in that direction. They are using tools like the Columbia Suicide Risk Assessment Scale to take a look at, you know, and various depression scales to screen people. Same way they are screening people for physical disorders.
Mm-hmm. Shalon James, when we spoke, you mentioned that, again, and I, you know, I told you that, you know, one of the things we wanted to talk about today was stigma. Mm-hmm. And you mentioned that in minority communities, it is especially evident that there is a stigma. Explain, if you would.
Yes. So in 2001, Surgeon General Dr. Satcher put out a report on mental health and culture and ethnicity, and he very systematically went through various minority and ethnic groups and talked about how different groups face mental health. So as an African American and growing up, mental health was not something that was talked about. You went to church. Something was wrong with you, you went to church, you prayed it away. That's how it was in my family. That's how it was for my community around me. And so it wasn't until I was an adult that I realized that there were a lot of people that were in my everyday circle that were suffering from mental health concerns, and we weren't treating it as a mental health concern. We were treating it as something that we handled within the small community of our church, of our immediate family, and we took care of individuals in the house. It's very similar to like Asian cultures, where they don't have, they're not putting their elderly into nursing homes. They take care of them at the home, and they pass and they get care in the home. It's the same concept of there are cultural beliefs and cultural things that drive people's motivation to get help.
So what do you do in a case like that?
You
or
break
cases like that.
Cases like that, you have to break people out of their routine and out of the stigma and say that it's okay. It's okay to say that this process isn't working for me. And you have to get the churches and the communities and the schools and, you know, the local leaders to say that it's okay for you to get this help and start talking about the issue. And that's, stigma is fear. Stigma is 100% fear. People are afraid of what they don't understand. And so until we start to educate folks and get them to a point where they no longer fear mental health and embrace mental health, then we can start to move forward. But as long as there's that fear there, people fear what they don't understand. And that's, I mean, that's what stigma is.
Well, let's get into some specifics. I mean, we've been talking a lot about reducing stigma. The state is also holding this up as a priority. But what does this actually mean when there are real consequences to coming forward about your mental illness? For example, could you lose your job? Chris Michaels, what about that?
We have people that experience that. They're employed and they don't talk about their mental illness, and then they end up in crisis, and the employer doesn't understand what's going on. And when they reveal what the problem is, then their job's not there for them. It happens all the time. Or we had one girl that was working at a clothing store, and she was like progressing up to become a manager of the store, and she felt real comfortable, she felt real secure and real confident, and she shared the fact that she lived with bipolar, and everything changed for her. Everything changed. All of a sudden, she wasn't performing well enough. She was getting poor performance evaluations, whether they were justified or not. But the whole attitude of the management staff in the store absolutely changed to her.
Well, you see, that's the point.
She regretted disclosing.
Right. Well, you see, that's the point, and I was getting to. Why would someone admit? Okay, it's not only society that is judging many people then, but if there's the possibility of them losing a job, or in the case, the example you just gave of getting poor performance ratings and that kind of thing, that she wasn't looked at the same way, you can understand why someone would be hesitant to come forward then.
Yes, that's the problem. That's a problem. I mean, that's one of the challenges. We just kicked off an initiative here, a program in southwestern Pennsylvania called CEOs Against Stigma, and we kicked it off this month, and it's a program that invites CEOs of companies, corporations, for-profit, non-profit, hospitals, universities, to come together and learn about mental illness, mental health in the workplace. We ask them to take a pledge that they're willing to educate themselves as much as they can about mental illness, and that they're going to bring it into their workplace. They're going to bring an open discussion about mental illness into the workplace, and they're going to we offer trainings for their employees. We offer trainings for their management and supervisory staff. We have offered to work with HR directors, HR departments, employee assistance programs. And this is something that they're finding that employers are very concerned about mental health in the workplace. Some of the statistics, and I know you didn't want to hear a lot of statistics.
No. Statistics are fine. Yeah.
Depression is a leading cause of disability worldwide, and it costs the U.S. economy $210.5 billion per year in absenteeism, lost productivity, and medical cost.
So, Shalon James, it sounds as if employers are part of that society that needs more awareness and needs more education as well.
Yeah, absolutely. So programs like this are I can't even explain to you how important programs like this are. Because if you turn on the news any given night and somebody shoots up their office building, the first thing they hear is, oh, they had a mental health issue, or, oh, he was seeing a psychiatrist, or, oh, he was seeing a therapist. And it's automatically, and so now people are afraid. CEOs are afraid because they don't want that in their building. They don't want that. And that is not true. That is a myth. Every person that shoots a gun does not have a mental health issue. The reason they shot the gun wasn't because of their mental health.
Right, and not every person with a mental health issue is violent.
Yep.
And
well,
that's another
see, that's
myth.
Just, that's the part I wanted to bring up as a myth, that actually the statistics show that those who are living with a mental illness are much less violent than someone who has not been diagnosed with a mental illness, correct?
Yep. Absolutely.
Yeah. Chris, I know this is something on the NAMI website that I see that you talk about often, that when that stereotype comes up, and just as Shalom mentioned, that, you know, you see these stories in the news. Now, you probably are talking about like some of the mass shootings. Many of those who are involved in mass shootings, not all, have been diagnosed with a mental illness, but people get that stereotype in their minds that those with mental illness are violent and that they will not fit in, and people are afraid. Fear, just as Ms. James said, fear is one of the biggest problems.
I just want to comment on that. I was at a local community council in Lancaster talking about our brand new hospital and what we're trying to do for the Lancaster community and the surrounding communities. And I had a pretty prominent community member say, are you bringing more violent individuals to our area with this hospital? Who is it that you have behind those walls in that building that sits right behind my store? I was actually quite taken aback by that comment. And it just goes to show that even at the upper echelons of society, this is still the view.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Coming up on tomorrow's Smart Talk, we're going to be talking about that. And this is something that may surprise some people, that there still are many women who are dying in childbirth here in Pennsylvania and across the country. And we'll be talking about that on tomorrow's program. But today we're talking about May as Mental Health Awareness Month. Our guest, Dr. Gina Cavorsi, Chief Medical Officer with Lancaster Behavioral Health Hospital. Shalon James, Director of Program Advocacy with the Mental Health Association in Pennsylvania. Christine Michaels, Chief Executive Officer with the National Alliance on Mental Illness, Keystone, Pennsylvania. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at SmartTalkWITF. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Let's go to Rosalind. Rosalind, you're on the air.
Yes, yes. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning. I have a daughter that suffers with, been diagnosed with paranoia schizophrenia, and she's self-medicating herself as we speak. She has been seen on May 17th on Market Street in Harrisburg with no clothes on, standing in front of a church crying, praise God, praise God. They videoed it, they put it on Facebook. She has a case manager from a place called CMU here in Harrisburg on Cameron Street. They're not doing anything about it. Crisis Intervention won't let me do anything. Roxbury Hospital, where she was at, they released her last year that she were to go to these partial classes and she were to have a bed at the Y. When they dropped her off, the hospital, Roxbury Hospital, just dropped her off back in Harrisburg, along on the side of a curve in front of this Help Ministry church. When I came there to meet my daughter, I embraced her and loved her, and we went in the place. They had no idea what we were talking about. They had no communication from Roxbury Hospital. Mm-hmm. From there, my daughter went right back out onto a drug called Space or mm-hmm. Wet, and she's just not taking care of herself. Crisis tell me, because of her age, I can't do anything. CMU case manager, they're so overloaded. They don't even know where she is. I just don't want to have to bury my daughter. I'm so tired. She has two children that I'm raising. They've been with me since they were newborn, and they're 8 and 12. And they're beautiful children, love Sunday school, love going to church. And, you know, Grandmom is a Sunday school teacher, but I have their mother that I constantly hold up in prayer. But I need for the state to help me, but they keep shutting doors in my face.
Hey, Rosalind. Can I keep you on the line and let me get your phone number? I'm going to have our call screener get your phone number too. But you do bring up a lot of good, when I say good points that I think many people have experienced. Maybe not to the extent that you have, your family has, your daughter has. But let me, if you would, provide a phone number for us in case, so we can get someone to give you a call back and maybe provide some help. Can you do that?
Yes, I can.
Okay.
We've been crying for help for years.
Okay. Hold on, and we'll get your phone number. I don't know where to start with Rosalind, but because she brings up several points there that you can hear the frustration, you can hear the pain in her voice. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, she probably has experiences that many people have had, maybe not to that degree, but that access that you talked about, Dr. Cavorsi, mm-hmm. that sometimes one organization, one agency, not knowing what the other is doing.
There's no warm handoff.
Warm handoff,
no
exactly.
Warm
that's
handoff.
That's what the language that the state uses when in relationship to the opioid crisis we have right now, yes. But it's a perfect way to describe it. Mm-hmm. What to do in a case like that?
I mean, my heart is absolutely breaking. And because this story is so common.
So common.
And there is an absolute lack of a warm handoff between organizations. And everybody is working in their own silo. And one person may be able to provide shelter. And one person may be able to provide food. One person may be able to provide medication. But all of those entities are working within their own silos and nobody's working together.
Why not?
And we have got to get to a point where the dollars flow so that we can work together as a team.
So money
this
is cannot, the problem?
The money is there. I think everybody's fighting for the same pot of money. And so everybody wants their money for their own silo. I want my money for housing because the housing is what is more important to me. And so I'm a housing organization. I'm going to fight for housing. And so there's not enough collaboration between groups and groups coming together and saying, here's the issue and we want to fight this issue together. We're not doing that as a society, and we're letting people fall through the cracks. And the one thing that I heard Rosalind say is that she was dropped off from a facility and there was no warm handoff. There was no person at the other agency that they had a name, they had a face. Somebody shook somebody's hand and said, hey, here's Rosalind and her daughter, and we are here. We talked to you on the phone. Here's their issue. Here's their concern. You told me that you had X, Y, and Z to be able to help them. Here they are. Do you have it? Yes, ma'am, I have it. We got it from here. And then that warm handoff happens to the next organization, to the next place.
Well, I mean, that, I don't know whether to call that an extreme case or not, but there's a young woman in crisis, and her family is in crisis. Two children.
Yeah.
Her mother.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
this is impacting everybody.
That's right.
This is impacting everybody.
Impacting everyone.
Mm-hmm.
And at the same time, you know, she's crying for help mm-hmm. and not getting it.
Yeah.
And that has to be so frustrating.
Horrible.
This is not an uncommon story.
Mm-mm.
I hear stories like Rosalind all the time in the inpatient mental health setting. as an administrator in a psychiatric hospital, we have to do a better job.
Mm-hmm.
We are working very hard to close that gap, the gap between what we're doing in that the inpatient setting and then getting people to the resources, to the services that they need outside of the hospital, because really, that's where the recovery occurs.
Yeah.
That's where people are going to build strength and move forward with their lives. Inpatient hospitalization is really just getting people over mm-hmm. the hump of their crisis.
Mm-hmm.
And then our job is then to connect them to the resources that they need
mm-hmm.
and do a warm handoff. Mm-hmm. You know, we've actually, at our hospital, we've been inviting these community supports into the hospital to meet with patients before they even leave.
Yes.
So whether it's a case manager or we work very closely with the Water Street Mission in Lancaster
mm-hmm.
And talking with them and making sure, yes, what does this person need to gain admission mm-hmm. to the mission?
Mm-hmm.
Well, what I hear, and again, this kind of goes back, and Chris Michaels, you can jump in here too. I go back to that example of if someone had cancer, someone had heart disease, would a hospital, a treatment facility, would a doctor's office just say, you know what, you're in bad shape, see ya?
Right.
No, and no.
Ever.
No. So why does it happen here, Chris? Absolutely. I mean, what's going on?
Well, they would do that if they weren't going to get paid. I mean, that's part of the problem with insurance. I mean, there are people with cancer that don't get treatment because they don't have coverage for it, or their coverage doesn't go far enough. But that's not the issue I think that we're talking about here. We're talking about a community-based system,
mm-hmm.
Community mental health-based system. That has been woefully underfunded.
Mm-hmm.
They have not seen any new money in over 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, it just the opposite. They experienced a 10% cut, like in 2011, 2012.
Mm-hmm.
That was never.
Now you're
restored,
talking about from the state.
Never restored.
Yeah, you're talking about from the state.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. And it's that funding. Okay. That funds the housing supports and the crisis teams and the peers and the the residential programs and mobile services and that go out to the people and the shelters and those type of things, the programs at the Y that offer rooms. Those aren't services that are like billable to Medicaid, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And they are services that have to be funded with state funds, and that are allocated to the counties to run programs,
mm-hmm.
and the counties are just stretched way way too thin with services,
mm.
And the mother that was talking talked about a case manager that is overloaded with cases,
mm-hmm.
and even if they are overloaded with cases, their biggest challenge that they have is resources. If they don't have any resources to offer folks in the community, these kind of things happen, and it's not right.
The other thing that happens is a lot of these programs that are out and that are available are one-shot deals. So you get it once. So I can help you with housing and help you get you in a place once, and then God forbid if you were to relapse, that service isn't available to you anymore. And so now you have one less resource out of a pool of maybe three resources in the first place, and now you have one less because you used it.
And just to piggyback on that, because of the resources are so limited, people have to rise to such a level of crisis to have access mm-hmm. to some of these things.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, if you've been in the hospital once, you might get a case manager that's carrying a caseload of 30 or 40 other
mm-hmm.
individuals. But if you've been in the hospital...
Who are all, by the way, in crisis, too.
Right. And, but Okay, so you have to get to the 10th hospitalization in order to get the intensive case manager who can actually meet with you once a week and really... So, I mean, so because our resources are so limited, people have to really, really be in dire shape in order to have access.
So, again, and just kind of pull this all together. So, resources, and you're talking about money, and you're talking about money from the state. I know that there are organizations, maybe your own organizations, that lobby legislators, lobby the state, saying, you know, here is the situation, just the things that we've talked about here today. We need more money. There are a lot of other people, organizations, causes saying we need more money. I wonder if part of the reason that you don't get more money, okay, we know that the come back and say, well, dollars are tight, we have to spread it around, which is completely true, I'm sure. But that because that stigma exists, because legislators are not aware of the statistics, only hear those cases of the daughter standing in the middle of the street naked, asking for help, that out of sight, out of mind, that a legislator is not thinking that this is a priority because they're not hearing it that often, and part of it may be because people are afraid to talk about it.
Mm-hmm. Until it's their daughter.
Until it's their daughter.
And
okay.
Until it's their daughter. Yep. And it will be, and it is, and I've seen it because I've gotten those phone calls. Mm-hmm. I've gotten those phone calls from people, very prominent members of the community, until it's their kid.
Let's go to Susan in New Cumberland. Susan, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Yes, you're welcome.
I have a quick comment and then a question. So my son has dealt with anxiety since he was little, and I just wanted to say to anybody listening, sorry I get emotional.
It's okay,
Susan. My child is dealing with this, that it is, they can do great and they can thrive.
Mm-hmm.
You need to stick with them, keep loving them, find them the help that they need. And it can be a lot better. Just it takes time, but it can get better. And my question is, in the book Mother's Reckoning, Dylan Klebold's mother refers to mental health as brain health, because she said, and I agree, that mental health is sort of something that you can't separate it from the body. It sort of makes it seem like it's a decision that someone's making. Do you think a reframing of the term mental health would help the stigma if we refer to it as brain health, because that's the problem?
Susan, thank you very much for your call. And before you answer that question, let me just make a plug here. Dylan Klebold, for those who are not familiar with his name, was one of the shooters at the Columbine mass shooting in 1999. His mother, who has written a book about brain health, will be a guest on our program and will be here in Harrisburg as part of WITF Summer Read. That book will be one that we will read. So we will have an opportunity to talk to her. We only have about 90 seconds left. The point that she brings up, should we be referring to it as brain health rather than mental health?
It's gone from mental illness to mental health. I think it's about education. I think it's about changing people's view of what mental health, mental illness really is. And letting people understand that everybody deals with it on some level. We are all affected by it on some level. And so we have to come together as a collective group, CEOs, nonprofits, for-profits, you know, churches, you name it. Everybody needs to come together and say, we're going to fight this head on and we're going to make this thing work.
Question here, and I only have about 40 seconds left. Chris Michaels, resources for people who want to maybe learn more about some of the topics that we discussed. I mean, we were all over the place today, but there's a lot more information. What about resources for people?
We have a wonderful website, NAMIKeystonePA.org, and it can hook you up across the state with every NAMI that's out there. We have 31 chapters, and our website links to our national website, which is just flush with information.
I want to thank all three of you for being with us today. I mean, there's a possibility that hopefully someone listening today that is in crisis, or maybe even just as you described, Shalon, that maybe just anxiety today. Dr. Gina Cavorsi with Lancaster Behavioral Health Hospital, Shalon James with the Mental Health Association of Pennsylvania, Chris Michaels, National Alliance on Mental Illness, Keystone, Pennsylvania. Thank you very much for being with us
today.
Thank
you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up on tomorrow's show, we're going to be talking about mothers and mothers who are having some problems in childbirth. That's coming up on tomorrow.